You can shop from anywhere doing pretty much anything. You might shop while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast. And however you shop, we all know and love the thrill of the hunt. But do you also know how to get the thrill of the best deals? Because Rakuten shoppers do. With Rakuten, they get the deals they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Sephora, Nike, and even Expedia if you're looking to get some travel in. And getting cash back doesn't mean you have to miss out on sales because those can just be stacked right on top. It's easy to use and based on a simple idea. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back through PayPal or check. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten.
Hey there. Ever wonder what happens to all those amazing screenplays that never make it to the big screen? Well, wonder no more. Welcome to Table Read Podcast, where we bring those undiscovered gems to life. Picture this, talented actors giving incredible performances with the occasional laugh or blooper thrown in, produced by award-winning pros. From drama to comedy, TV pilots to feature films, there's something for everyone. And guess what? We release new episodes every week, so don't forget to hit that subscribe button. Table Read Podcast, where great stories finally get their chance to shine.
I am Hugo Vrsaljevic, the only grateful compulsive gambler in the room. I just know that I was put on this earth with now knowing so much, and after 20 years knowing that this is the time to tell people that recovery is a beautiful thing. Going to therapy should not be a stigma. Going to a 12-step room should not be a stigma. It should be celebrated.
I'm probably one of the few people I know who still looks forward to my Sunday newspaper. Not a digital copy that I read on my phone, but the real finger-staining, loud crinkling, section-by-section newspaper. The Sunday paper for me is a treat to be enjoyed while lounging in bed and sipping hot lemon water. So one day when we were going through all of the Only One stories that are being submitted to us, thank you for those, by the way. We love reading them. It was Scott's idea to record and release a few of them occasionally, but always on Sundays, and call them our Sunday edition. And because they're only 30 minutes long, our hope is that you can enjoy them while sipping your morning beverage, going for a walk, or even just enjoying a lazy Sunday at home. Please enjoy today's Sunday edition and be sure to listen every Tuesday when we drop another brand new episode of The Only One in the Room. Hugo Vrsaljevic, hello, how are you?
I'm doing wonderful.
Well, of course you are. As you know, we'll get to the name of your website and your kind of motto for life a little bit later, but I knew you would say you were doing wonderful. I have a question for you before we start the interview. I want to know if you can remember the first time you ever made a bet.
It was Cotton Bowl, 1978. I was in sixth grade, Notre Dame versus UT. $5 bet with the person who was actually running my CCE classes. I was growing up Catholic, but at the time I was in public schools. So since I wasn't getting Catholic teaching at the schools, I bet the person, he was in the seminary, so he was learning to become a priest.
Yeah.
Did you see him as a sucker at that time?
I did, because he wanted to take Earl Campbell and the Texas Longhorns, and I took Notre Dame as a good Catholic, and I won the bet.
Ah.
But here's the thing. I never got paid.
Uh-oh. So there's, well.
There was a resentment.
Yeah. If he's listening. You owe Hugo. What would you have won?
$10?
Oh, $5.
But $5 back in 1978 when you're in sixth grade was a big number.
Well, plus interest over the years compounded. That's something. All right. Thank you for that. I am Laura Cathcart Robbins, and this is The Only One in the Room, special Sunday edition. But I am never the only one in this room because, as usual, my boyfriend, producer, and co-host, Scott Slaughter, who I call Hun, is here as well.
Hey, honey.
Hey, honey. So I'm going to tell you what we're talking about today. You and I both found this to be really fascinating. Mm-hmm. It's gambling. So usually people start out gambling for fun and they end up chasing their losses until all their money is gone. And in many cases, people are gambling because they have faced some emotional or financial losses and they're just trying to console themselves. But most people don't realize that problem gambling is a real disorder, just like alcohol and drug addiction. The good news is that we find that people, or it's found that most people who get treatment are able to successfully stop gambling. So here to dive into this with us, we have Life is Wonderful founder, Hugo Vrsaljevic. Hugo has over 20 years in recovery from gambling and alcohol.
Wow.
So yeah, welcome, Hugo. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
So Hugo, tell me, how do you identify?
I identify myself as an addict, someone that's grateful for the 12 steps of recovery, for therapy. I also identify as a proud born in New York, but grew up in Texas, Bolivian. My parents are Bolivian, Croatian. And so I'm a combination Latino, Eastern European, and I'm proud of my background.
Wow. Wow, that's a great identification. Thank you for that. So I'm just going to kind of jump right in. And my first question to you is, how did drinking, like vodka and beer and betting, go together for you?
It was all part of the family structure, the environment. My dad always drank. My uncles drank. I mean, the males in my whole family were always drinking. And so that was just part of growing up. I mean, I had my first taste of beer when I was 8 years old because my dad would like to pour a beer and I'd love to kind of sip the foam. And my parents thought it was okay, but you know, as you're taking the foam off the beer, you're still ingesting some alcohol. So when you're 8 years old, and we all know that with the growing brain, that's very dangerous. So I slowly kind of got into that kind of addictive mode. And then because I always played sports, I was always growing up, started off with baseball, but then it was mainly just football and basketball. Sports was always part of the environment. So I was always watching sports. And just got more into, oh, there's actually, you can bet on sports. And then it just started early on. Like I said, my first bet was in sixth grade.
Wow. So when we talked, I wrote down this quote. You said, she heard how drunk I was and she knew the Rockets lost, so she wouldn't let me come over. Can you tell me about that night?
Yeah, that was the last time I drank alcohol. It was back in 1997. The Houston Rockets were playing the Utah Jazz in a playoff game. This happened to be game 6. And went out with some buddies to the game. We were actually, back then the Rockets played in the Summit. Was drinking. It involved beer and tequila. Also was betting on the game. And then the Rockets lost, got eliminated from the playoffs. Was still drinking, was at a bar, and then I called my girlfriend from a payphone when there was actually payphones in bars. This is kind of shows you my age or our age. And I just asked, hey, I want to come over. And she said no. And then that feeling of rejection, that feeling of anger, of almost depression, desperation, and then just all being slammed like in my face.
What do you think it was about you at that moment that she didn't want to be around?
Well, she had told me before, she didn't appreciate it when I would go to Rocket games or playoff games with my buddies or my brother and just get really drunk and then want to come over, not really to see her, just to come over, just to have sex. And even sometimes she even said, you would come over and you'd be telling me about the game or the night, and then I would just pass out. And then she'd be like, well, why'd you come over here just to pass out? It just felt that she felt insulted, which I get later on after going through therapy. I finally understood the female point of view of what males could do when they're drinking, gambling, doing drugs, or, you know, doing whatever, how you always are thinking of only yourself. You don't realize how your behavior impacts others.
Right. So that was your bottom with alcohol. That was May 23rd?
24th,
1997. So what was it about that encounter that made you decide, I'm going to put down alcohol?
Well, about 6 months earlier, I'd invited over her to Thanksgiving with my family. And she, after we had left, she made a comment, I think your family drinks too much. And of course, I immediately got defensive, thinking, God, what a bitch. That's a little bit. I'm trying to, you know, be, you know, this is about a family affair. We're talking about enjoying Thanksgiving. And the first thing is some criticism. And when you're an addict, this is how I always felt. I could not hear any type of criticism, whether it was about me or my family. It just felt like somehow there was something less than. I always heard something less than, or there's something wrong with me.
Yeah.
And it just hurt to the core. But so I had that in my mind. Is so then after this night, you know, it was just that whole week. And I was kind of thinking about, can I got to do something different? You know, I'm 30 years old. You know, I'm looking around, you know, I'm not married, you know, I don't have a house. I don't have kids. I don't, you know, I had my own business, but it just felt like I got to do something different. And since I was still gambling, I said, well, let me at least just not drink and I'll go to a meeting. I'll go see what this whole 12-step thing is about. And I would just, in the beginning, I just thought, I'm just not going to drink for a week. I just said, I just got to just stop for a week. And then it just, one day, like they say, just do 24 hours at a time. And I did 24 hours, and then a week turned into a month. And then later on, I realized I didn't really need alcohol. But it increased my gambling addiction for the next 3 years because I still needed an escape.
Right.
I still didn't know anything about emotions. I was still had the emotional disease. I just wasn't drinking and gambling. I was just gambling.
Did you feel like drinking and gambling kind of gave you the same like rush or hit the same, what's the word I'm looking for, hon? Like satisfied same
yeah,
like,
high. It was the same
yeah,
high.
Yeah, thank you.
It did. Well, it did, but I was always much more of a compulsive gambler than anything.
Okay, like so if I went explain to Vegas, that, yeah.
Well, so if I went to Vegas, I would still want, I would, obviously the main focus was gambling, but I still wanted to drink. I still wanted to go pick up women. I still wanted to eat as much food as it was possible. So I was going at all levels. It just was as I just loved betting on sports, which was football, basketball, baseball, and on the horses. That's the type of gambling that just gave me the rush, just like everybody has their favorite drink or their favorite drug. I'd like to drink beer, vodka, tequila, bet on the horses, and bet on sports. And bet on football, basketball, baseball, whatever the season was at the time.
Sure. And so when you took the alcohol away, you say that the gambling increased.
It did. And actually, my depression went higher too. I could feel myself almost isolating more because gambling to a point, just like any addiction, but it always seems like gamblers, and I've talked to a lot of them, is we're such loners. An addict can be a very big loner, but compulsive gamblers are almost at another level of isolation because they have to hide all the money schemes to get money, whether you protect the money that you have or come up with money to pay so you can either go back to the casino or pay the bookie, or nowadays, obviously, you can do scratch-offs. There was a lot more isolation with the gambling, and that which led to the depression.
Did you ever have trouble with bookies? Like, did you owe and people came after you? Like, that's what I see in the movies.
Yeah, I know, but you cannot believe anything you see in movies.
Right.
Now, I didn't live in New York City. I never dealt with the mafia. I didn't have those types of books.
Right.
Most of the books, you know, they were in college. They were either within the fraternity, within all the different fraternities. There was always a couple books. And, you know, as a gambler, you ask enough questions, you know who the better bookies are around town. It's just like if you're into drugs, you ask enough questions, you find out who the better drug dealers are.
Sure.
You attract what you want to attract. So, yes, in certain times you did get in trouble with bookies. But they just wanted the money. They were not in the business. You know, they would give you a little bit of time. They could cut you some slack. They might even if you owed a little bit of money, or the bookies that I dealt with would still allow you to bet, but they'd kind of minimize it because they just wanted you to stay. It's like Vegas. They just want you to come back.
Right.
You know, for them, they just want they want enough money on both sides of the game and just collect the juice. And then that stays in business. It's exactly why Vegas hotels keep getting bigger and bigger, because people are losing and losing.
Right. Well, and I think you told me this when we were on the phone, that gambling isn't about money, it's about action. And
it is.
Yeah, and you described like making bets over the phone, feeling like a junkie driving to the dealer. Is that right? Did I write that down right?
Pretty much. So what would get me the most high was in the morning when I woke up and I would look at the sporting lines. So if people don't know much about gambling, back then, especially in the 80s and 90s, the only thing you could bet on was the line. So there was always, it wasn't like picking a team to win. A team had to cover the point spread. So if the home team, let's say there was the Dallas Cowboys and the Pittsburgh Steelers, and if Dallas was at home, the number you would see in the paper was 4. So for you to win, and if I bet on Dallas, the favorite, they'd have to win by more than 4 points. Now, so if they only won by 3 and I picked Pittsburgh, I would win. So, but the lines is what got me high. It's like sometimes when people would talk about, they would get to Vegas and they would be checking into the hotel and they could start hearing the coins from the slot machine. And all of a sudden their juices, almost like their blood pressure would start rising. The adrenaline would be going.
Right.
Because we would be getting high before actually placing the bet. So I'd be high in the morning. And then actually, by the time I actually placed the bet, called in the bet with my bookie, that was just almost a transaction. And then I'd have to watch the game or wait till the game was over to find out if I won or lost. So I'd either maybe feel this momentarily feeling of elation or dejection.
Yeah.
Depending on how much I won or lost or how many games were going on. But yeah, it was always in the morning. It was, yeah, I just had to be in action. And that's what all a real compulsive gambler just gets high before they're actually gambling. And it has nothing to do with money. It just has to do with the escape.
Interesting. Thank you for explaining it like that. That was, what were you going to say, hon?
I was going to say, it reminds me of knowing I was going to get drugs in the evening. Like all day would be really good. You know,
right.
And then by
right.
the time you got them, it was a letdown. But it, I mean, you know, only for a moment. But,
right.
but the reality was that there was a real cycle to that high of the expectation.
Yeah.
And then a real sense of putting it back together after it was over, too. Mm-hmm. You know,
the anticipation.
Yes.
Is actually more powerful than the actual experience. Mm.
Well, and I think that goes across addictions. That goes for food, that goes for love and sex, that goes for alcohol and drugs, and obviously now for gambling. That anticipation is part of it.
As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch, and organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/realm.
Are you thinking about getting into Dungeons & Dragons? Maybe you're looking to expand your horizons as a DM or a player. If that's the case, then it's time for you to check out The Dungeon Cast, the best D&D podcast out there that helps you passively learn all about the game just by listening. Find The Dungeon Cast anywhere you get podcasts or on YouTube.
How would you compare the highs between alcohol and gambling and the lows? Were the highs similar, or were the lows lower in gambling?
The lows were lower. I mean, for when I was drinking, I was more of a binge drinker, and there was nothing like that first taste of beer as it just went down my throat. I could just feel like, oh, it was like a quench. It was almost like that Lipton iced tea commercial, yeah. Like the aha.
Yeah, you know, yeah.
The exhilaration, like falling backwards into a pool. It's like,
yeah.
God, there was nothing better than a cold beer or a shot of tequila. But since I didn't drink every day, you know, the morning is, yeah, I'd feel hungover. Or I can get through it, or I, you know, I would deal with it. The gambling was kind of was much deeper in terms of the lows, because you would start looking, okay, how much, you know, the money or the games or how much, you know, it was, everything was on a weekly basis. So it didn't have to come up with the money like every day.
Right.
So it was like you'd have to pay out on a Tuesday and collect on a Thursday.
Mm-hmm.
Did you gamble every day?
Only when I stopped drinking. So the years 1998 and halfway through 1999, I gambled every single day, except there was 2 days at that time where I could not gamble. And that was the Monday and the Wednesday after the Major League Baseball All-Star Game in July. Other than that, you could always be able to bet on football, basketball, or baseball. And sometimes if you needed that quick little fix, you could go here in Houston. I think we still have a dog track. You could go bet on the dogs, or you could bet on the horses. But the horses never really did not run on a Monday. So there was always, and I don't think the dogs did either. So there was always that kind of like, almost like, now I'm really angry and depressed because I can't even find a fix.
Right, right. So, and then that's kind of what I wanted to talk about next, because you took a trip, right, to South America. Is that right?
To Europe. You mean when I ended up finally quitting gambling?
Well, yeah. I mean, and I could have this out of order. So you're sober from gambling since April 13th, 2000. Is that right?
May 24th, 1990s. Oh, yeah, from gambling, April 13th, 2000.
Yeah, correct, yeah, yeah.
So there's a three-year period.
Yeah, and then, so did you take the trip prior to your sobriety date?
Yes.
Okay, so can you tell me about that trip then?
Okay, well, I'll just interject one quick fact. So in December of 1999, I actually went and sought a therapist. And this is the definition of crazy. I knew I was going to continue to gamble, but I didn't want to let my therapist know that I am still gambling.
Right.
So I was paying a doctor, a psychologist, for a year and a half just so I could lie to him.
Yes. Yes.
It shows you just how crazy I am. And I could tell people, I'm getting help. Mm-hmm. I'm in therapy. I'm not drinking. Leave me alone about my gambling,
right.
Please.
Right.
You know, yes. How much more do I have to do? You know, always trying to be the martyr, you know, the victim, play the victim. You know how addicts are. I played the victim as much as I could. You know, it was
sure.
Poor, poor, pitiful me, the immature behavior. So I knew I needed to stop gambling. So March of 1999, I actually call and find out where the 12-step meetings were, because there's not as many meetings for gambling compared to alcohol in any major city. And so there was at that time only 5 meetings for compulsive gambling in all of Houston. So I found out where they are. I wrote them down and I never went. So now another year goes by. Now we're at March 2000. I call the number again. I think they added one more meeting. So there were 6 meetings. And so I actually go to my first meeting. It was the Sweet 16 of the NCAA tournament. I said, well, if I have to listen to a bunch of people talk about no more gambling, I have to bet on the Sweet 16, the early games at 6 p.m. Meeting was at 7 p.m. So I bet on 2 games at 6 p.m., one at 8:30. I remember going in, I was winning both bets. Lo and behold, I ended up winning the early bets. Of course, after, it's almost like the jinx. They always say it's like the recovery jinx. Once you start coming to meetings, you're going to start to lose, even though anybody who goes into a meeting is already a loser. We're already losing. You don't, no one goes into a meeting on a high going,
right.
Hey, I just won $10,000. They're usually depressed. It's usually after a bad
right.
weekend, or their wife or their parents are telling them, you know, you need to do something because this is, you know, I'm tired of bailing you out. So I go to the meeting. And so for about 3 weeks, I was going to meetings. I was gambling like every other game or every other day. And I already had a trip planned. I was going to Portugal. And so it was almost like that whole thing. It's like why a lot of people go inpatient, because you got to get out of your environment. And I would always be, you know, at a certain point, I'd get an urge to call my bookie to find out, okay, what are the basketball and baseball games going on? And I remember the last bet right before I left for Portugal, I bet on the Los Angeles Dodgers. And you can actually name your pitcher. There's a lot of tricks. I don't want to go into all the details about gambling, but I knew Nomo was pitching for the Los Angeles Dodgers. And I always thought, well, okay, Nomo's going to give me some good luck. And I remember I bet I was down, and they had a thing. So you had to be either owe more than $300 or you'd be owed more than $300 to pay. You didn't have to pay if you were just down between $100, $200. And I was over the 300, and I remember Nomo got me under the number. I was down to like about 180. So I didn't have to deal with a bookie, and then the next day I could go to Portugal. And so being Catholic, growing up Catholic, my parents, you know, we always went to a school run by nuns, went to a high school. It was an all-boys school run by Jesuits. So a lot of the Catholicism and a lot of the different beliefs were very strong in me. So when I was in Portugal, I went to Lisbon. I was there by myself. And, you know, I loved being in Portugal, just being out of the country, just out of all the stuff, whether it was work, whether it was actually temptations to gamble, whether it was actually going to 12-step meetings, which I was still trying to figure out if this is what I wanted. It was almost like another form of escape, but at least it was a healthy escape. I wasn't harming myself. I wasn't doing anything. And because I couldn't call back and forth with my bookie, I never felt the urge to call, so I could kind of focus. And so in Portugal, about an hour north of Lisbon, is a town called Fatima. And in Fatima, in 1917, is when three kids were said to have actually seen an apparition of the Virgin Mary. You know, it first started in Lourdes, then it went to Lourdes happened in like in the 1880s. But in Fatima, so I went to Fatima and I was there and I walked, you know, where, and I felt like this power. I could feel God. I could feel that something special happened here. And obviously, you know, growing up believing, and they have, you know, different stations of the cross, different stuff. You know, they actually built a basilica where it actually happened. And I show it in one of my videos, but there's a path and there's this open doorway where you walk in. And if you're actually praying and asking for help from your higher power, from God, he will help you. And I was doing this and I was crying and I was doing everything. And I go through the door and I just like almost finally felt that God was in my blood. And then I go down and they sell a lot of candles. I bought three candles. I bought one decent-sized candle for each of my parents, one for my father, one for my mother. And I bought the biggest candle I could afford or what they were selling for me, because I said, I need a candle that's going to burn a long time, and I need a lot of help. And I was asking, I was sitting there praying, doing all kinds of Hail Marys, Our Fathers, just basic talking to God. And I did it. And then I came back, and I was finally ready to accept my new life of recovery, which meant that I was going to go full throttle and actually be completely honest in therapy. I was going to do anything they asked in 12-step rooms. And I was going to two types of rooms, one's for alcoholics and one's for compulsive gamblers. So I would go to alcoholic meetings in the morning. I would go to therapy once a week, and then I would go to compulsive gambling meetings at night. And then I just went all in, and I had to finally believe, because I had heard for 3 years where they say how it works. Half measures avail us nothing. And it was so true in my case. I wanted a better life, but I was unwilling to dive completely in. And it is so scary. And I understand it is so scary to change and look at every relationship, even family relationships. Are these people safe? Can I say certain things? Because my family did not support me when I said, I'm going to go into 12-step meetings. I'm going to go into therapy. They thought I was talking a different language.
Right.
And I was completely, and that was another form of feeling the only one in the room, where I was completely alone. except for at the time, still had the girlfriend, even though we kind of had a, it kind of felt like the relationship was halfway, but at least she was supportive and she would say, hey, I'm proud of you. I'm glad you're going to therapy. I think, you know, you can find some answers. And I just needed that. And my brother's first wife, she would be like at family dinner and she would have to almost say it in a whisper, like, oh, I'm so proud of you going to meetings. Well, tell me what it's like. Because she knew if she actually raised her voice that it could start a conversation and there was going to be a lot of almost like negative. Even though my parents, my brother, other family members really wouldn't say anything, she kind of knew it was almost like that taboo subject.
Sure.
I could go into other stuff, but I just knew it's what I needed to do for me. I just finally said, you know what? This is for me. And I just really loved the literature. I loved the people in it. And I found I got this unconditional support and love that I so desperately needed and wanted. And I was able to kind of go. And that's how I was able to just keep doing one day at a time.
That's amazing. I love that story so mm-hmm. much. And we just have a few more minutes. So I wanted you to tell us about Life is Wonderful.
Okay. So I've been in both recovery groups for a long time. And I'd heard a lot of people, you know, come in and out. I've heard a lot of stories. And we were going to a retreat, one for a compulsive gambler. And I was talking to another guy. We were going to do the overview. I was going to do step one and he was going to do step two and three, which was Friday night. This was like a 3-day retreat. And it just kind of so happened is that the person who was supposed to do the wrap up was not able to do it. And so the guy who was running the retreat said, hey, can you just do the quick wrap up? I said, okay, this was on a Saturday night. And then I went to my room and I thought, okay, how do I want to wrap it up? And me and this other guy who kind of talked about it, we wanted people to get more enthusiastic about recovery. You know, that this is such a beautiful thing. Believe in the miracle of recovery. Believe that we are all miracles of life and that we all deserve a better life. We do not need to be in that cycle of addiction or even in the cycle of not being able to own our own story, that we're so scared of rejection that we don't even tell people who we really are. So I went to my room and like I shared with you, I had this epiphany. And so I rewrote the 12 steps into something that I thought would just be memorable. I've been in public speaking in the 90s and I always wanted to kind of figure out to get back into public speaking. So like step one, instead of saying we are powerless over gambling or alcohol and our lives become unmanageable, I just said, we believed a lie. You know, just kind of say, okay, the lie of addiction. And, you know, step two is we need help. And it goes all the way to step 12, which is faith, hope, love. And I rewrote them and I've done videos on each of the steps. And I've done videos now on other topics like gambling, gratitude, depression, even the spiritual principles like honesty. But I was always just, and it just kind of just grew from there. So I did one video. I said, well, I want to do something on YouTube. So I did a video, not thinking I was going to do much. And then it just kept kind of growing. And then from there, I got a logo. I was working with an assistant. She was helping me with the graphics. I came up with a tagline. I, you know, hired someone to do a website. And now I finished out an online course. And, you know, just, and now I'm starting a podcast. I'm just doing, it's almost like everything kind of grew from
that one
someone
concept.
Just asking me to just do an overview. And it's almost to me is that finally God was telling me, just like he told me back in Fatima, this is your purpose. Even though I have another business that does industrial supply, and I love that part of the supply chain, I just know that I was put on this earth with now knowing so much, and after 20 years, knowing that this is the time to tell people that recovery is a beautiful thing, and it's mental health. Going to therapy should not be a stigma. Going to a 12-step room should not be a stigma. It should be celebrated. You know, just like when we go to a meeting and people celebrate, if you got 30 days and you get that blood red chip, that is something beautiful. You should have a big smile on your face. You should be able to go out and, you know, get yourself a milkshake or some beautiful meal that you want, you know, something that really brings you pleasure.
Yeah.
And, you know, and people should be celebrating instead of so many people going, well, I'm afraid, you know, what is my family going to think? So tired of hearing that. That's why I have shared in all my videos all the accomplishments I have done either before I got sober, or even after, and I've accomplished more after sober. And even all the dumb shit that I got myself into. I got so many stories I can tell you, whether they're financial, sexual, relationship, business, family, all could travel. Because I've gotten myself in these predicaments. And that's the other thing I want to just leave with is that we can now laugh about it. I can now laugh and share about all of my stories that, you know, that used to bring so much almost shame or guilt. Like, I don't want anybody ever to know. Is I'll tell you all the stuff that I've done, because I want people to know that we are all real. We all have things that we regret doing. But if we look back on it now, it should be looked back on it with almost a smile and go, I am so thankful I became a compulsive gambler. I'm so happy that I drank way too much from the age up until 30, from pretty much 13 through 30, and I gambled between pretty much 13 through 33. That was actually a gift. You know, a lot of times people, we regret, don't you regret that? No, because without going down those depths, hitting rock bottom, I was able to find myself and actually learn to get into therapy and actually learn to actually feel. Because I was pushed academically, athletically, and spiritually as a child. That's what my parents pushed. But I didn't know anything about feelings until I was 31, when it was the first time I actually saw a feelings chart. And I didn't know, I couldn't pick out a feeling. And my therapist would go, you know, only five-year-olds have one feeling at a time. He goes, if you were really in tune with your feelings, you can have multiple feelings. And I couldn't even say anything because I was confused. I was like, okay, I'm willing to learn.
Wow.
And I was willing to just get in there. And so now I can feel and actually know now what it's like when someone says, do you love somebody? I actually now know how to give love and receive love. And that's the whole beauty of recovery. And the message I just want to keep sharing and what, you know, Life is Wonderful is about, you know, my tagline is empowering people through self-awareness. I just want people to understand themselves better. You find out who you are and then own your story. Own all the stuff that you went through to get to where you are today, because it's a beautiful story. And I wish more people would just realize that their lives are beautiful and that their story is worth sharing.
Yeah. Well, I think more people will realize that after listening to you today. And I hope they visit your website. Is it lifeiswonderful.com?
No. I got it better than that.
Oh, tell me.
Lifeiswonderful.love.
Oh, that's right. It's lifeiswonderful.love.
Right. Love.
And everyone goes, how did you get that? I go, it was available. .com was not available. And they had .co. They had lifeiswonderful.life. And I go, well, that sounds redundant.
I
saw .love, and I was all over that. I go, I'm buying that domain name.
Yes. So go to lifeiswonderful.love. And see what Hugo is talking about. And Hugo, are you on social media?
Correct. I'm on Instagram. It's still the same thing. Lifeiswonderful.love.
Okay.
The podcast is Life is Wonderful. YouTube is Life is Wonderful. But there's a song out there. So right now, it's hard to find me on YouTube. It's easier if you go to my website. You click on a video. That takes you straight to all my YouTube, and then you can subscribe or listen to any video that you want and look at the different playlists.
Great. Well, this has been so enlightening. I learned more today about gambling, but just more about the shift and what's possible. And I so appreciate you sharing your story with us. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
I appreciate the time. I love sharing about recovery.
Yeah. Yeah, we can tell.
Uh-huh. I'm evident. So glad. I feel like I've been at a great speaker meeting.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you, Hugo.
Yeah. Thank you, Hugo.
Thank you for listening to The Only One in the Room. Please join us each Tuesday and Sunday for an incredible brand new Only One interview. And every Friday for On My Nightstand, where I'll be reading something that I love. If you have an Only One story you'd like to share or a piece of writing you'd like to submit, please send it to theonlyonepod@gmail.com. From all of us at The Only One in the Room, we wish you dopeness, health, and prosperity.
Have you ever watched a futuristic sci-fi movie and wondered, but wait, could any of this really happen? And will I live long enough to see it? That's what our show Hypothetical is about. I'm Carrie Bechet, and on this podcast, we ask what-if questions about the future. Like, what if we could read minds? What if the world's digital data was erased all at once? What would happen if the Yellowstone supervolcano erupted? Then we explore that question two ways, through speculative science fiction and through dialogue with brilliant scientists. The result is a genre-bending narrative that's interwoven with real facts provided by literal geniuses. And, spoiler alert, a lot of the science fiction out there, it's not nearly as far-fetched as you might think. Come time travel with me into the future on Hypothetical. New episodes on Tuesdays, available on all your favorite podcast apps. Just search Hypothetical. That's H-Y-P-E-R-T-H-E-T-I-C-A-L.